Oh my goodness, do we have a packed house in the Red Studio this morning. It's time for Kitchen Table Talk. John, take us away.
Oh, good morning, everyone. This is John Lundorf. Normally, you hear me in short form on Radio Nibbles every week, but we've started doing this wonderful once-a-month hour-long show called Kitchen Table Talk, which my co-host, Dan Asher, and I came up with. And it's designed to talk about all things food in Boulder and beyond. And it's an hour, and we're going to welcome your calls. And by the way, what is the phone number folks should call in on?
Oh, it's behind you on the wall if you ever need to remember it. And that number is 303-442-4242.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
That's young Daniel there. And would you like to introduce our guest?
Oh, my gosh. It would be an absolute pleasure. I'm extremely excited, first of all, to be right next to you, John.
Yeah, we haven't seen each other in a while.
In a little bit, yeah. So good to see you. And such an honor. Talk about a studio full of talent. I think we're going to need to get a contractor in here and bust out some walls before the end of the show. Two amazing, talented, brilliant culinary masters and that have deeply influenced the food scene, Boulder, Denver, and beyond. First of all, Edwin, thank you for joining us and bringing your amazing perspective on cuisine and restaurant life. In general, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
And Edwin, of course, owns the remarkable Zomama and Dragonfly Noodle, and also Zomama in Denver.
Yeah, and Dragonfly in Denver as well. So four restaurant brick-and-mortar locations, which is mind-blowing in itself. and then the amazing Eric, who has decided to take upon himself three of the most challenging tasks known to humanity, which would be chef and restaurant ownership of farming and ranching. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Busy as always.
Sure, and, just a little busy.
And, well, geez, I've known Eric a long, long time. But currently... Bramble and Hare in downtown Boulder.
Indeed.
And the Black Cat Farm store, which we'll talk about in a few minutes.
Indeed, which is a heck of a lot of fun. And yeah. For me, a new take on the same food, the same, you know, sort of palate and deliciousness, right. Yeah.
And then at some point in the indefined far future in a different reality, perhaps Black Cat Farm Dinners.
Yeah, they are. I can see them on the horizon.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, but you've been saying that for a year.
Probably. I have. Also true. Also true.
And, it's a good horizon.
And if you don't know Daniel, you know, he's got a whole bunch of food stuff. You know, Oshkar, River and Woods, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, lots of blah, blah, blah. Exactly. Well
so,
said.
So let's roll in. I thought a great place to start when we were talking beforehand. Eric, you know, you were saying that someone had asked you about the nature of the culinary culture, the chef culture, the restaurant culture in Boulder, and I thought it was a great way you put it.
Yeah, so, you know, so I've cooked in Washington D.C., I've cooked in San Francisco, and then here in our community, and. You know, and it's all food and, you know, fancy restaurants there and, you know, fancy restaurants here. And you know, interestingly, I think we're all doing the same things in all these places, but here it ends up being different. And the big difference is for me and, you know, in those other cities, it was very cutthroat. There was a, you know, a schadenfreude, sort of a joy when you saw another restaurateur go down in flames, or when there was some sort of a problem, you know, that meant that in the zero-sum game you were in a slightly better position or whatever. It was very, very, very challenging. Here, it is the exact opposite in this community. The the chef community are they value each other. They lift each other up. If a cook in my kitchen was sick, I would have no qualms shooting a text over to Daniel or to any of the other chefs in town and say, "Hey, I'm really in a bind. Can you send a cook over?" And the answer would be absolutely yes. Everybody here helps out everybody else.
Or a case of asparagus or anything else.
or anything else,
yeah,
exactly.
A cup of sugar, yeah.
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. And I love it. I really love this cooking community. Mm. And it, for me, it's a reflection of the community as a whole. It's a really wonderful place.
Because
to be.
That's also true of the brewing community, which
the
is notoriously collaborative. Also, distilling. Mm-hmm. A lot of collaborative.
Phenomenal collaboration. I think the beauty of this area is that instead of this embedded fear of competition, there's this beautiful awareness of abundance and rising to challenges together.
Indeed.
Yeah, which makes it very different than many culinary cities. I couldn't agree more, Eric. Yeah.
What do you have on your mind, Daniel?
I wanted to talk about the idea of legacy cuisine. And Edwin, I wanted to speak to you about specifically the idea of, you know, the concept of passing on, you know, culinary knowledge and the idea of ceremony and the idea of craft and how that translates to creating a culture of love that is deeply embedded in the food that you do. If you could talk a little bit about what that means as far as family, connections with your mom, like how things brought in what you do so well, and how that inspires your restaurants every day.
How many questions is in there?
I think 11. 11 questions.
Well, I think for me, food is, in the Asian culture, food is a very central part of their culture. And certainly in my family, that's always been the case. And you know, when I think of my mom's cooking, I do think of love. You know, the care that she puts into it. And I think most of us understands that.
Yeah.
You know, eating, food, even when it's not, at its best execution, the love overcomes a lot. You know?
So true.
And I remember a very funny story that my father told me, that when they first got married, Mama was actually a terrible cook. Because she never cooked before, and then so she prepares this meal for my father, and my father said it was just absolutely awful.
Wow.
But he told her that it was delicious, and to reward the compliment, she made the same thing for the next 2 weeks.
That's,
you know,
love.
But
that's love.
That is love. But through that process, you know, she got better and better and better until, you know, she just makes extraordinary, you know. And we talk about legacy cuisine, you know, foods that that everybody in that culture understands. For example, like today I brought over some hot and sour soup, which is one of the really popular and one of the standards of Chinese soup. So give that a try.
Oh, that is exceptional. Thank you.
Which is, this is a very different experience than perhaps some other similar soups I've had in my dining.
Yeah, and also this soup, even within hot and sour soup, the way this one is made, it has much more home style flavors, rather than a more commercial, you know, a restaurant flavor.
It's delicious.
Yeah. Thank you.
And you know, so that does bring, I think that's hilarious about your mom. I think I want to know about the other moms involved. Eric, what'd you learn from your mom about cooking?
I learned that I'm a wreck in the kitchen. My mom was very, very clear that I made a huge mess. And
like a lot of chefs.
You know, and, I loved the kitchen when I was a little kid. Whether my grandmother in the kitchen or my mom, absolutely fascinated by Julia Child. You know, shows, all of the old PBS, you know, things. That's what I watched when I came home from school, after school, eating milk and cookies. And my mom had this this ability to know I had walked in the kitchen somehow telepathically, and I had to hear her yell from across the house, "Eric, get out of the kitchen, you make a mess," whatever. And, you know, and I don't know, maybe that is what has drawn me to the kitchen. It was the forbidden, you know, the forbidden fruit for so long.
And Dan, tell me about mom.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Similar to Eric, I was obsessed with cooking shows, which at the time was only on PBS.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Julia Child, Jeff Smith. I mean, I would
Jeff Smith.
Have a little notepad. Yeah. Remember? Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Galloping Gourmet. I mean, this was, you know, and I was born in Montreal, Canada, so we had Pasquale, who was this singing Italian chef who would break into opera in the middle of his cooking show. I mean, it was unbelievable. And it was the same way. I had a notepad. I'd write down recipes like furiously because they would just show it on the screen for a few minutes, like a couple times throughout the show.
And how old were you at this point?
seven.
See, yeah. So obviously we're, you know.
7, 8 years
four,
old.
Four very different kinds of guys.
And I was at my mom's side obsessively in the kitchen. Same thing. She was like, she said, "You're like a tornado." I just started in one part of the kitchen and worked my way through, and the counters just looked like, and I love that.
And now all these chefs, I'm just going to break in here, you know, because I've worked in some professional kitchens. They want to get to be executive chef so that there's like dishwashers and other people to clean up after them. Just an editorial comment there. And my mom, the beautiful Rosie Lendorf, you know, the best things in my life happened in the kitchen. And I would sit there, and my dad would come in, and we'd talk, and mom was cooking. And eventually she put me to work. The first thing I made was Prince lasagna from the box.
Nice, you know,
I grew up in New England.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing is, sort of reveals my age here, but when I was little, Julia Child was on educational TV in Massachusetts. It was the first time that was on. And for reasons I can't understand, really, still, my father, who was an Austrian immigrant doctor, loved Julia Child and would sit there laughing uproariously. And I sat there with him, and I watched her, you know, with the chicken. And I just want to let folks know, by the way, if you go to the Julia Child Facebook page and other media, they're releasing snippets of the original black and white show. Mm.
Oh, wow.
Showing her making an omelet. Showing her making
the
Duchesse potatoes. I mean, it's beautiful. Anyway, my mom, for whatever reason, did not think it was weird that I wanted to be in the kitchen and wanted to cook, and was always proud.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's how it should be.
I think we should also talk a little bit about the relationship between chefs and farmers. Eric, of course, you can just talk to yourself, I guess.
which
I know you do all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I can just ask his wife. No. Tell me a little bit about what's changed in the relationship between chefs in Boulder County and restaurants since you started farming.
Yeah, interestingly, you know, it's a sea change has happened over the last, you know, 15, 18 years. When I first landed in Boulder and I was going into the farmers market, you know, as a young, bullheaded chef, I was asking the farmers at the time, "Hey, I want these little tiny baby carrots because they look so cute. Can I buy all of your asparagus? Can I buy this, that, and the other thing?" And I got a stream of no's nope, we're not going to grow that for you. No, you can't buy all the asparagus because I have all these other customers that I need to take care of, that sort of thing. And that sort of wall of no's was, you know, really one of the big things that sort of spurred me into doing things on my own, starting a garden, you know, at the house, and so forth. But now, two things have happened. One is that farmers are much more accommodating to the needs of chefs, and at the same time, chefs are much more accommodating to the needs of farmers. And so
what does that mean, practically speaking?
Sure. So the farming community has expanded and matured. There are lots of, you know, there are lots of farms around. So there are many more farms that are willing to tie themselves in, work side by side, shoulder to shoulder with a chef. And 18 years ago, that really wasn't the case. There was really, you know, a handful of organic farms, in the area, and all excellent, but all of their product would be sold. And so there was no financial incentive for them to link up with some wackadoodle chef who had, you know, crazy ideas about how to do things or whatever. And at the same time, for the chef community, we were seeing things that were made in New York City or in LA in Gourmet magazine or whatever, you know, or we'd take our, you know, trips to the coasts to see cuisine, what was happening there. A lot of that is rarefied, and so we would want to bring those sorts of ideas back, you know, here. But the farming community, you know, there was no incentive for them to grow that sort of vegetable, with that sort of a look. And so, really, the two communities have, over time, have, you know, come to understand each other and be willing to, you know, really work side by side. There are really a large number of farms which tie themselves in with restaurants such that the farmer and the chef are having long, meaningful conversations, not just about what do the carrots need to look like, but what is a sustainable financial model. Really, Mr. Farmer, what do you need financially to make your business model work? And Mr. Wackadoodle Chef, what do you need in order to make your, you know, business model work? And the two have been now over the last, you know, let's say 15 years, have been working towards this one sort of common understanding. It used to be oil and water, and now it's mayonnaise.
Nice. So you like that?
You like that food
very
metaphor?
Nice. That's very good.
So Dan, you've really, you know, you've nurtured some relationships with local farms and local
amazing people.
Like who?
Doing incredible work. Jeez, Munson Cure. Just started doing a little bit with Wyatt at Red Wagon after the soil. After the soil event, I want to get more engaged there. Oxford Gardens, Peter.
Michael at Kilt.
Aspen Moon's doing incredible stuff.
Yeah, he's a great farmer.
Yeah, I was just talking to the folks at Yellow Barn. They've got a new egg program that they're trying to transition to commercial.
We could have a whole
the egg thing is
separate
extremely
discussion about
that's
eggs.
Olive eggs. I believe it's Bella that I met that we're going to start integrating into brunch eggs at River and Woods. It's a constant dialogue. It really is. It's about seeing what has to make the most sense for everyone to win is really where it starts. And there has to be a lot of flexibility on both sides. And I think it really comes down to the shared idea of wanting to present something meaningful, something that someone has worked very hard to do, and you want to honor the journey of the farmer that was doing this work months before any of our culinary teams were thinking about what we want to do ourselves for a new dish.
And Edwin, is it harder Because you're looking for more particular crops?
Yeah, the challenge is really different in the fast casual space, and specifically in the Asian fast casual space, where you know the opportunity to work with farmers is a little bit more limited because of the ingredients, the key ingredients that we're trying to source. Mm-hmm. For example, garlic chives. Is one of the ingredients that we use, but you rarely see that even in a lot of Asian restaurants.
Right.
So the last opportunity that I had to even start a relationship was actually with Mr. Dave Jablonski of Boulder Cafe, who, you know, was a wonderful gentleman and great friend that he ended up, you know, passing away before we could do anything. But even within that context, even if he could provide that, we needed basically X quantity, you know, 7 days a week. And so if we were to make that happen, then we will have to look at how to dovetail that with our regular supply chain and be able to fit those things in. So.
And I want you're listening to Kitchen Table Talk on KGNU. And our guests are three amazing Boulder chefs, Edwin Zoe, Eric Skokin, Dan Asher. And you are welcome to call us here down at the station.
Please do.
And ask questions about agriculture, restaurant issues, and also cooking. You can call 303-442-4242.
Excellent.
So please do call us. Let's talk about let's switch gears a little bit, and we've got folks out there listening in their home kitchens or cars or wherever they are. I'd like to give them some extraordinarily easy winter an idea for a winter meal that they can throw together that is genuinely easy and not. Wackadoodle, I think the word is.
Word of the day.
So, Edwin, it doesn't have to involve noodles, but in any case, something that, you know, where people go, oh, I could never make that because it's just too complicated. Yeah.
I'll let Eric start first because I need to process that.
Okay.
Yeah. So I encourage at our farm stand when I, you know, sort of dole out, which is one of my favorite things, doling out recipes at the farm stand. What am I going to do with these carrots? Well, let me tell you. You came to the right place. One of my favorite generalized recipes to give to people is to encourage them to break their crock pot out of the cabinet that they never ever use.
Yes.
And it's wintertime, and a crock pot is really the ideal thing for making a braised meat of some sort. And it could be lamb, or it could be pork, or it could be beef, and it doesn't really, or chicken, or whatever. It doesn't really matter. The key thing is setting your crock pot so that the liquid on the inside is about 174 to 175 degrees. If you want to split hairs, 174 and a half is actually better than, I'm just kidding, than the other two. That temperature ends up being really ideal for braising and creating really spectacular restaurant temperatures. So you see all of the, you know, really fancy restaurant geared equipment and that sort of thing. And really it all comes down to getting meat to cook for a long period of time at this 175, 174 degree, you know, temperature range. And then, you know, you can let, you know, you can let the flavorings and the things that you see, you know, whether it's at my, you know, farm stand or, you know, at the farmer's market or whatever, it doesn't really matter, end up dictating, you know, the direction you go. The leeks can look spectacular and be inspirational. The carrots are incredibly sweet, so maybe I'll do something with those. You know, so it's a collection of vegetables that you love, and it's, you know, some sort of, you know, braising cut, whether it's a lamb shank or whatever.
But you braise the meat before.
Right, and so the first step would be to brown things off, you know, the vegetables and the meat, and then you plunk everything into your into your crock pot and you dial it up and then you adjust the temperature until it's 175.
And then you go to work.
Well, then you go to work or you go to bed. So in restaurants, most of the time, all these braising things that we're talking about happen overnight while all the chefs are sleeping. You know, we all have these sort of specialty ovens and braisers, right? And you can do that as well. And man, breakfast in the morning when your kitchen smells like a wonderful braise is it's the greatest.
Yeah.
Hey guys, we got a caller.
All right.
Welcome to KGNU, Lynn. Hello, Lynn. Hello.
How do you spell? Can you hear me?
Spell what?
I wanted the spelling of the Asian soup.
Why don't you try calling back? We can't really hear you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So, Daniel.
Yes. I couldn't agree more. I was going to exactly say the same thing about the trusty crock pot. You know, the OG Instapot, for all our listeners out there, was actually like the Moroccan tagine or a beautiful Dutch oven. That was, you know, before there was this amazing technology of not having to worry about anything. But back in those days, you had to worry about a lot of things, and you were worried about coaxing flavors out of your food properly.
Yes.
And developing things.
But a simple meal.
But a simple meal that is affordable, and you could feed a family nourishing, vibrant, incredible, nutrient-dense food.
Yes.
Very affordably.
Yes.
And that's what it's about. So you pick up a well-priced cut of meat from a local farmer, like some chuck roll, and an amazing bunch of vegetables to develop flavor. You know, I'm always an advocate of mirepoix. Brings out amazing flavors. Carrot, celery, onion as your base. Mushrooms, root vegetables, beets, carrots. You know, and then the forgotten things like kohlrabi, that if you have a CSA box, you know, you get, depending on the end of the season, these terrifying vegetables like celery root and kohlrabi, and everyone's freaking out. I don't know what to do with this stuff. You can braise it. You can shave it raw. There's so many amazing things you can do. But those weird, crazy root vegetables that are extremely intimidating and strange, you can dice those up, throw them in the crock pot with some beautiful broth. Go get some of Kirsten's incredible from Boulder broth, some of her amazing bison broth or chicken broth or vegetable broth. Use that as a base. Fill up your crock pot. Yeah, and as the saying goes, set it and forget it.
We love that.
Yeah. And your kitchen will fill up, as Eric said, with flavors so nostalgic and transformative that they will redefine the course of your day.
And if not the aroma at breakfast, then the aroma when you walk back in the house after a long, cold day.
Yes.
You know, and you walk in and it's there.
Yeah.
And the whole place just...
It's amazing.
Yeah. Divine.
That's what it's about. Crockpot cooking, I couldn't be more of an advocate for. Yeah. And that's what restaurants that do these beautiful, you know, winter braises and this, you know, everyone's addicted to, you know, braised short rib. It's all about time temperature controls.
But it's slow.
And there's like $20,000 combi ovens that do that. And there's $39 countertop crock pots that do that.
And you can also just use your oven.
Yes, you can. Totally.
And that's what I do. Actually, my column today in the Daily Camera is on the passing of gas stoves, which I know you guys will find hilarious.
Yes.
It's just a matter of time till they don't exist in home kitchens anymore.
Yeah.
I understand why you got to have it in your in a commercial kitchen, but I think it's going to change over time. In any case, the thing I love to do is turn the oven on, you know, because you're cooking something anyway. Take some carrots, peel them. I have some beautiful purple ones at the moment. Mm-hmm. Put a little bit of oil, a little bit of salt in a cast iron pan or otherwise. Put it in the oven and then, you know, go work for a few hours.
Yeah.
That's really what it's about.
Exactly. Yep.
Edwin.
Yeah, in terms of dishes, that's really easy to do and that's great for the family. For me, it's fried rice.
Uh-huh.
You know, for a lot of people think it may be challenging. But there are just a few tricks to it. You know, first is that most people don't realize that you don't use freshly cooked steamed rice. You use leftover rice and rice that you, if you don't have any leftover rice, and cook it, and then let us cool down, sit in the refrigerator, you know, uncovered for until the next day.
So it dries out a little bit.
Yeah, it dries out a little bit. Otherwise, yep. It's too much moisture. It's called fried rice, not steam rice, for a reason. And then the second thing is that, you know, very often eggs is used in the fried rice. But what most people don't realize is that you really have to put quite a bit of oil so that the eggs really puff up. You know, it isn't just a little bit of oil and do a kind of a scramble, like a soft scramble egg. That's not what we're going for. So make sure you add plenty of oil and get it really hot. Put it in there so that it really puffs up. And then you can add all the leftover ingredients and seasoning. So,
that's great.
Yeah. We're at the top of the hour here on KGNU, and we have a few announcements.
KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver.
Support comes from Avery Brewing Company in Boulder, sponsoring KGNU's 2023 Mardi Gras Bash, taking place on Saturday, February 4th at the Avalon Ballroom. Tickets and information can be found at kgnu.org.
Hey y'all, celebrate with KGNU Radio and CFCZ at the Mardi Gras Bash, February 4th at the Avalon Ballroom in Boulder. It's an evening of music and dancing with Curly Taylor and Zydeco Trouble. Doors, 6:30 p.m., dance lesson at 7, music at 8, costume contest with prizes, the more outrageous the better. Cajun eats for purchase and a cash bar. King Cake complements this healthy serving of Cajun Creole culture. Tables for large groups and tickets on sale now at kgnu.org.
Hello, everybody. This is John Lendorf, and you're listening to Kitchen Table Talk. It's our monthly show about all things culinary. Sitting in the studio, it's a remarkable thing. Three really unique and wonderful chefs in Boulder, Edwin Zoe, Eric Skokin, Dan Asher. We're all sipping on hot and sour soup.
It's so good. Right?
And it's really good.
Talk about nourishing broth.
And we have a caller who has a question for us.
The caller is Neil. What's your question, Neil?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You were talking about the improving relationship between the restaurants and the farms. And it seems to me that over the years that farmers market, some of the farms have left maybe to concentrate purely on the restaurants, or that there's more emphasis on restaurants and CSAs than the farmers market itself. And I wonder if that's my imagination or if the you all has on that.
Thank you very much. I'm going to let Eric start on this one
because it's qualified.
Sure. Well, it's a complicated issue and goes to the survival of farms.
Yeah. You know? So I think your observation is fairly accurate, but I don't think of it as, you know, there's nothing nefarious, you know. I don't think farms are eschewing the farmers market, you know, for other things. Really, I think what we're seeing is that the local farming community is becoming more mature, that there are more farms entering into the marketplace. When you think back to, you know, 15 to 20 years ago, with only, you know, four or five farms servicing the community, really all of their everything that they could possibly produce was snapped up lickety split. You know, by 10 o'clock in the market, there was pretty much nothing left. And now, as more and more farms enter into the market, it got to the point where there was plenty of organic produce left at the end of the market at 2 o'clock, and then it got to the point where there was a surplus that was never sold, and then at that point there was a market incentive for farmers to think, ah man, I harvested all this arugula, how am I going to unload it so that I don't have to compost it, you know, back at the farm, and at that point farmers started looking at restaurants as being a viable place to start selling, and some restaurants, I'm sorry, some farms have really enjoyed that experience and they decided, you know what, this is easier for me. I'm going to specialize and I'll just go off in that direction. And other farms have decided, you know what, I love the one-on-one contact with a family and that's enriching, you know, to me. So I'm going to double down on CSAs. And then others, you know, love the sort of free-for-all of the of the market.
But what about you?
I love.
But what are you doing?
Yeah,
this year
we do all three right on our farm, and you know our farm is has always been about taking care of the restaurant. That's, you know, 60 to 70% of what we produce goes into Bramble and Hare, and then at the Black Cat or at our the farm dinners, or at the farm stand or whatever. We have a small. A group of CSA members who've been CSA members with us for years and years, and we absolutely love them. That's the smallest part of our operation. And then the farmer's market and the farm stand are wonderful. And you know, partly we do those because I love doling out recipes. that part is that's the secret sauce. You know, but it's also for us, you know, great, you know, marketing to, you know, have a bunch of Black Hat Farm carrots sitting on your counter and then knowing that there's a fancy restaurant in town, you know, where you could have the same, you know, carrots produced or whatever.
I think we should mention that I think you have the only year-round farm stand.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're open year-round. We've been... open, you know, we've been, our farm has been producing since our year round, or at least trying to, since the second year of the farm.
Right, but this came about in part because of COVID. Right?
It did. Yeah, all of our produce used to go into the restaurant in the winter time, and then when COVID happened, we opened our farm stand, and obviously because the restaurant had been closed, and then and that has turned into its own customer base, and you know, because the restaurant is always open, it makes sense for us. It always has made sense for us to grow year round. So we have production.
And your farm stand is where?
Our farm stand is at the intersection of J Road and the Diagonal on the north side of town.
And with a little luck, soon it'll be a farm store.
And trucks. You want to talk about the truck model that you did?
Oh, man, that was so much fun.
That was amazing.
Yeah, so I was at the farm stand. Here's the background story. I was at the farm stand. I had a conversation with a customer. Like, oh, thank goodness you guys are open. You know, like this. You know, this spinach and this. You know, great. And this is at the peak of fear at COVID time in that March and April time when we're all just beside ourselves. And this customer said, I'm buying extra spinach. I hope you don't mind, but my next door neighbor hasn't been able to make it, can't get onto Instacart, can't get a food delivery, and is petrified to go to a grocery store. And so I'm buying for her. And I thought, if this person has a neighbor who's doing that, there's probably dozens, hundreds, you know, a thousand or more neighbors who are afraid to go to the store. And so that was the initial idea. Let's bring the farm store to each person's house. And we called it Mabel the Farm Truck.
And
yeah, it was amazing. Like a vintage ice cream truck full of the greatest organic vegetables.
It was great.
Yeah.
We have another caller. Laurelyn is on the line. Laurelyn, are you there?
I am. Good morning. And I was happy as I was driving down the road to hear someone mention garlic chives. Quite a few of those growing in my yard. They're beautiful and flower. And other than snipping them up every so often and throwing them in eggs, I don't know what to do. So I'm curious about the person who would like a quantity of them. What piece are you throwing them in?
Edwin, what do you use garlic chives for? Amusingly, I actually have a little pot of garlic chives growing in my window.
Well, I think we can start a co-op from the sound of this. We use it for mama's pot stickers.
What else can you? But you, in other words, all the other things you can use them for. Anything you can use chives in, or scallions, or other things.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to cook them.
very much.
Well, you can use it like in a stir fry, you know.
Yeah, but not like it's not something you braise. It's
no.
Like
yeah,
like an onion. Or
something. Yeah, it's for a stir fry. It's a quick
finishing
process. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we have another caller. Lynn, are you there?
You hear me this time?
Yes, I can. What's your question?
Can anything go in pierogies besides potatoes?
All right. Well, let's. Yes, absolutely.
Garlic chives.
One thing.
Very well said. I mean, well said, chef. Yes.
No. I mean, there's actually a lot of different variations on pierogies and pierogi. Yeah. I've had them with green chilies and things in them.
Oh, that's great.
I imagine sweet potatoes or yams will be just as interesting.
Yeah, sauerkraut and cheese. Mm-hmm. Delicious.
Mm. All right.
My grandmother made a version of them, Czech version, Nidlitsky peaches. She would can peaches and then make the dough and wrap peaches. And that was dessert for us. So if you can envision a pierogi with a fruit on the inside and then...
that's a kolache.
Yeah. Well, Nidlitsky, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
excuse me.
Everyone settle down.
Yeah, stand down, please. Yeah. Yeah. One war is enough right now, okay?
Yeah. at one point, you know, when I thought about opening a restaurant, which I no longer do, just in case you were asking, I was
smarter than the rest of us here.
I was only going to sell dishes that were things that had things in them. Ravioli.
Stuffed.
Because who doesn't love a dumpling?
It's true.
Or a calzone? Or, you know, I mean, those are some of my very favorite foods in the world. And this was incredible. We actually have another caller. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's your question?
About short ribs. I heard you mention them. I've had lovely short ribs in American and Chinese restaurants. I tried to make them at home, and I've got some really nice meaty ones with bigger bones than usual. Some more regular ones from another source. I try browning and grilling to begin with. I finish them in the oven or a crock pot, and I can't get that connected tissue to dissolve. How do you do it?
Let me see if I got the question. Did you guys kind of hear?
Yeah.
We were having a little few audio difficulties there, but did you get the gist of that?
Yeah. So the browning part is correct. So, you know,
that we're talking about short ribs.
Yeah, for short ribs. The browning part is a critical flavor building first step. And that can happen on the grill, like you mentioned, or it can happen in a cast iron skillet, or however you want to do that. In a restaurant, we'll often do that in an oven because of the volume. You know, we have a lot of them that we have to, you know, produce for a night or whatever. And then, keep in mind, that's a very high temperature in order to create browning. And then you need to reduce the temperature down to that sort of magic 174, 175 temperature. And so that you'll cook them either in broth or in a Dutch oven with the top on, but you really need the temperature around the meat to be in that 174, 175 sort of a range. And then it's just forget about it and you know, come back later. It's a time issue. Most of the recipes that you read will have a 350-degree oven and blah, 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 and it's just far too hot. Keep the temperature lower. Lower and longer.
Which works really
they
well.
They can go for a very long time.
Right.
At that temperature, you can do them days.
Yeah.
Literally 24 hours. It's totally, and they're beautiful 24 hours later.
It's true.
Cooking. Yeah.
And so that's kind of a Western approach to short ribs. Edwin, there's a whole other school of short rib.
I think really the two main factors is time and temperature. Increase one, the other decreases, and vice versa. And on a really geeked out technical level, is that the connective tissues and the collagen starts to break down around 190, 195. And so if you have a relatively short amount of time, say several hours, then you can put it in. Actually, one of the really great ways is to invest in a really good pressure cooker.
Yeah.
Because they're extremely energy efficient, which is one of the things we really value at our restaurants, is to be really efficient with our energy usage. So if you put a pressure cooker in there, and then set it to the right temperature, you can have really, really delicious, you know, fall off the bone short rib in a matter of, I would say, probably 2 or 3 hours that you can be had.
But then
how do you season them?
Well, for us, you know, we actually have the Sichuan braised beef noodle soup, which we use the chuck short rib.
So is it a thick noodle?
Well, no, the cut of meat.
I mean in the soup.
Yeah, the noodle is generally a little thicker to balance against the stronger flavor of the braised noodle soup. But in terms of the flavoring, you know, a little bit of anise and Sichuan peppercorn. To me, some bean paste, it just really, really blends into the...
That's great.
Yeah. The black bean paste?
Yeah, the black bean paste.
Delicious.
This is remarkable. Well, I like this next caller. Hey, John, it's John. You got a question for us?
I learned to cook with techniques in the 60s. Traveled a bit and discovered what... five-star restaurant.
John, I'm going to have to say, I'll take your call out in the hallway. We seem to be having problems again with the phones, so I'll be right with you.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'd love to, you know, if we can talk about the idea of, you know, knowledge from elders being passed on in many ways, and the beauty of what that is specifically in a culinary environment, you know, going back to like the idea of apprenticeship and learning, you know, we had the blessing at River and Woods of Chef John Pizarro passing on his Gnocchi Verde recipe, which he showed me how to do before we opened 7 years ago. And it was amazing, to have that. And that was served, you know, in his restaurant, John's, for decades. And to have that passed on, and, you know, we make it every day. It's just part of the soul of River and Woods, is we just roll gnocchi by hand every day, and then, you know, and then blanch them off and portion them out and get them ready for service. If both of you can speak a little bit to something that you do in your kitchens, obviously I'm assuming that, you know, the dumplings, you know, something that represents that, you know, knowledge from an elder being passed on, which is something we unfortunately are losing in many different cultures, but is something that needs to be protected and held with a very high sense of reverence.
Yeah, for me, I think that some of these dishes are really challenging to pass on in a restaurant environment, because we do have the business pressure to make sure that the numbers can come in correct,
sure.
You know, come in to be able to stay,
to
keep
be
it, yeah, to be viable, to keep the doors open. And one of the dishes that, you know, Mama is going to be 80 years old this year, you know. So it's incredible, but it also speaks to the fact that she is getting older and she just can't not keep up with the production. As much as I whip that, you know, crack that whip, she just can't.
I was in there the other day. It was amazing. Just hundreds. Yeah, yeah. Incredible.
Yeah. Mama, we got to go faster. and one of those dishes is what we call the zongzi. Zongzi is, I describe it as kind of a Chinese tamale. In that, you have some sticky rice and pork belly and lotus seeds and, you know, different ingredients.
Is it wrapped?
Yeah, it's wrapped, except that the her style is very, very specific to southern Taiwan. So
what is it wrapped in?
It's wrapped in bamboo leaves.
Yeah. Cool.
But it's in this kind of a geometric, interesting shape that people just have a really hard time doing. So we actually stopped doing that for a while, and then I have asked her, you know, maybe just once a week to make that. And short of us putting forth a lot of effort into kind of a very obscure little dish that's extraordinarily, to me, from a culinary perspective, very important, because we actually had a customer come in, not an Asian customer that you would expect. And he ate that. He says, "Is your mom from Kaohsiung?" It's like someone, you know, eating tamales and be able to identify the region of tamale that came from.
Wow.
So you know, from that, you know, perspective, you know, it troubles me that I may not be able to carry that on, because in a commercial environment that just can't happen. But
right.
Perhaps maybe in a virtual form, or perhaps just doling out recipes, we may be able to do that.
Right, so, exactly.
Yeah.
Shannon? That's amazing.
So we are literally playing telephone here, and okay. I am passing along the questions from the callers who are on the line. Marilyn from Boulder has a question on food distribution. How can you get food from your farm to a distributor or anyone who is in need of it? Well, I wish I could clarify.
Sure. Yeah. No. So our distribution model is, you know, it's just insanely simple. It's us harvesting in the field, and then a pickup truck, and then it goes to our farm stand. And the farm stand is about 5 miles away from the farthest field from where the so they're your carbon miles, about five or
that's
so.
That's a good impact.
Yeah, it is. you know, and then it's the same pickup truck, which then rambles through Boulder and until it makes it to the restaurant, and then it unloads the rest of it. Mm-hmm. The key thing, I think, we have this uniquely, you know, wonderful model, which is a good fit for our community here. But there are a lot of local farms and incredibly talented local farmers, in this community. We're rich that way as a community. And so heading down to the farmers market on Wednesdays and Saturdays when it opens, zipping around to some of the local farm stands also very, very possible. Right. And then the Boulder Farmers Market has an online pickup in the wintertime, which most people don't know about, but I would encourage people to go to the Boulder Farmers Market website, and then you can take a look at some things that are for sale from local farms and then distributed through the farmers market itself.
That's great.
Yeah.
And did we have another question?
Not immediately, but I am going to ask people to send their questions to dj@kgnu.org. I can read out your questions here on the air.
I don't believe in all these years that we've had quite so many questions, and I'm really thrilled.
Yeah, we actually have three callers on the line, but
and it won't work for sure.
I would say the better option is
to just
email dj@kgnu.org.
Yeah, and we have a few minutes left, so get those messages in. We have a few more minutes left. Anything you've got coming up this summer with your restaurants or anything coming up that you wanted to mention while we're here?
Yeah, we're planning trying to figure out the music series in the backyard at River and Woods. We have a beautiful new pergola that was constructed. So we're trying to figure out what that's going to look like with bringing in some local talent, doing a little backyard barbecue action. Yeah. Great winter menu. At Ashkara in Boulder with some beautiful new dishes.
Edwin, anything coming up?
Well, let's see. There's one pretty big announcement, I guess. We're breaking it here, is that we're moving to Omaha Boulder.
What?
I know. Yeah.
Really?
Yes, we are.
That's ancient.
Wow. That's congrats. That's a,
thank
that's
you.
A,
thank
where,
you.
Where are you going?
So we're moving just half a block onto Pearl Street where Chipotle used to be located.
Wow.
Yeah. Whoa.
I got Cosmo Jacks.
Well done.
Well, thank you.
Hey,
thank
great.
You. Yeah, so I think that's kind of a big
congrats.
Big
yeah,
deal,
that's
I guess.
Huge.
So, yeah.
Hey, we've got another caller.
Okay. Well, it's a question via email.
Oh, sorry.
Gnocchi Verde, what is the green part? That's the first question. Second, where can you get a good carrot in the winter? And question number three, where can you get scrapple in Boulder?
I'll answer the carrot question.
Whoa.
Because
scrapple is great.
I just ordered some food through the Boulder County Farmer Market online
portal. Yeah.
The portal. And there's some incredibly, incredibly gorgeous purple carrots. Actually, I think there were some other, a lot of other carrots, because that's what you get in the winter. Mm-hmm. But those are the ones that I'm going to roast and do wonderful things with. The other question was about
the
green part can be various things, right?
Spinach, yes.
In this case, it's
beautiful,
spinach.
Yeah, it can be baby spinach, can be your beautiful, vibrant, regular bunch of spinach. But that is the green part of the Gnocchi Verde spinach. Very high nutrient content, Popeye approved.
I was eating in a town in Italy, San Donato Val di Camino, and I had Gnocchi Verde, and I had a wonderful conversation with the with one of the people in the restaurant, and they were using nettles. And,
Cool.
And so, and that, I think my understanding is that's the traditional. So the nettles come up early in the spring, one of the very first crops.
That's great.
So those get picked and then washed and then blanched and then chopped, used the same way as spinach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and the flavor. That's
is so
great.
Good.
Got to watch out for the little stingers.
Well, once you blanch that, all
right.
that goes
yeah,
away.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed.
Want to avoid the raw nettle situation.
Yes. Yeah.
You got to, it's kind of like the first guy that ate an oyster. You got to wonder about the first people that ate nettles.
And they were like, this isn't going very well. Maybe we should blanch these. Yeah. And what a scrapple. Oh, my God, such a great dish. Talk about beautiful regional comfort food. Yeah, scrapple. Didn't Dot's Diner have scrapple at one point?
I think they
thought
did.
Dot's had scrapple.
Long, a while back.
And then Lucky's Diner. I thought Lucky's had scrapple.
Have a very non-regional question. What is scrapple?
Oh, it's God, I'm trying, you know what? I got to
look. It's parts.
Bits and pieces.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know the trotters or the head or you know all the little bits all sort of boiled together and then pressed into a sort of a loaf or a tureen would be the French word.
And here's why I love things like that. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day. Ranchers like Erica, you grow whole animals, you know, and you don't just grow fillets.
Indeed.
Give us time.
Right. But, well, actually, I take it back. There are people growing them from cells, which I find truly horrifying, just saying. But it's using the whole animal, using everything that's part of that animal, whether it's broth or scrapple or braised, like that pork dish on the Bramble and Hare menu.
Indeed.
Yeah.
You know,
indeed.
It's just use it all.
Pennsylvania Dutch. I was just looking at the origin of Scrapple. 17th and 18th century German colonists who settled near Philadelphia and Chester County, Pennsylvania.
Use it all. Folks, this hour went way too quickly.
Jeez.
This was absolutely wonderful.
We
will post it online so you can pass it along to your friends and neighbors. I want to just thank everybody. Edwin, thank you for being here. Thank you for bringing the soup.
Oh, thank you.
Get the soup. Go and get the hot and sour soup today.
So good.
Eric, a joy to see you. Glad you like my
pepper. Thank you.
Glad you like my pepper. Eventually, I'll figure out what kind it is. Dan, good to see you in person.
So good. Amazing, John. Yes.
Yes, we're back.
Back in action.
Thanks, everyone.
Have a beautiful day.
Thank you.